The Weave-Off. A week or so later, the usual crowd gathered round her, Arachne sat at the loom, completing a tapestry that represented the founding of Thebes. Gasps and moans of appreciation greeted her depiction of the dragon-tooth warriors rising from the earth. But the oohs and ahs of her admirers were interrupted by a loud knocking on the cottage door. It was opened to reveal a bent and wrinkled old woman.
"I do hope I've come to the right place," she wheezed, dragging in a great sack. "I'm told a wonderful weaver lives here. Ariadne, is it?"
She was invited inside. "Her name is Arachne," they told her, pointing to the girl herself seated at her loom.
"Arachne, I see. May I look? My dear, these are your own? How superb!"
Arachne nodded complacently. The old woman plucked at the weave.
"Hard to believe that a mortal could do such work. Surely Athena herself had a hand in this."
"I hardly think," Arachne said, with a touch of impatience, "that Athena could do anything half so fine. Now please don't unpick it."
"Oh, you think Athena inferior to you?"
"In the matter of weaving, it's hardly a matter of opinion."
"What would you say to her if she was here now, I wonder?"
"I would urge her to confess that I am the better weaver."
"Then urge away, foolish mortal."
With these words, the wrinkles on the ancient face smoothed away. The dull, clouded eyes cleared to a shining grey, and the bent old woman straightened herself into the magnificent form of Athena herself. The crowd of onlookers fell back in stunned surprise. The nymphs in particular shrank into the corners, ashamed and frightened to be seen wasting their time admiring the work of a mortal. Arachne went very pale, and her heart thudded within her. Yet outwardly she managed to keep her composure. It was disconcerting to have those grey eyes fixed upon her, but all their wisdom and steadiness of gaze could not alter the plain truth.
"Well,"
said she with as much calmness in her voice as she could manage,
"I have no wish to offend, but it is, I think, undoubtedly true that as an artist of the loom I have no rival on earth or on Olympus."
"Really?" Athena arched an eyebrow.
"Let us discover, then. Would you like to go first?"
"No, please." Arachne vacated her seat and pointed to the loom.
"After you."
Athena examined the frame.
"Yes, this will do,"
she said.
"Phocian purple, I see. Not bad, but I prefer Tyrian."
So saying, she pulled from her sack a quantity of coloured wools.
"Now then."
Within seconds she was at work. The boxwood shuttle flew back and forth, and magically, wonderful images began to appear. The crowd of people pressed forward. They saw that Athena was bringing to life nothing less than the story of the gods themselves. There was the gelding of Uranos in all its gory detail. How sticky the blood looked! There, the birth of Aphrodite. How fresh and damp the ocean spray. Here was a panel that showed Kronos swallowing Rhea's children, and here another of the infant Zeus being suckled by the she-goat Amalthea. Athena even wove into the tapestry the story of her own birth from Zeus's head. Next came a dazzling depiction of all 12 gods enthroned on Olympus. But she wasn't finished yet. As if deliberately and publicly to humiliate Arachne for her presumption, Athena now created panels that showed the price paid by mortals for daring to set themselves up as equals or superiors to the gods. In the first, she showed Queen Rhodope and King Haemus of Thrace, who were changed into mountains for daring to compare their grandeur as a couple to that of Hera and Zeus. And in another panel, Athena wove the image of Gerana, Queen of the Pygmies, who proclaimed her beauty and importance to be greater by far than that of the Queen of Heaven, and had been transformed by an enraged Hera into a crane bird. In that same corner, she wove a picture of Antigone, who had her hair turned into snakes for a similar act of impudence. The gods later took pity on her and changed her into a stork. Storks ever after ate snakes, apparently. This was not the Theban Antigone, daughter of Oedipus, but a Trojan girl of the same name. Finally, Athena adorned the border of her work with designs of olive, the tree holy to her, before standing to receive the acclamation that was her due. Arachne was gracious enough to join in the applause. Her mind had worked as fast as Athena's shuttle, and she knew just what she was going to create. A kind of madness had overcome her. Having found herself in the unlooked-for position of competing against an Olympian goddess, she now wanted to show the world not just that she was the better weaver, but that humans were better than gods in every way. It maddened her that Athena should present so grandiose a subject as the birth and establishment of the Olympian deities and then depict such clumsy fables of punished hubris. Well, two could play the game of parables. She would show her. Arachne sat down, cracked her knuckles, and began. The first form that came to life beneath her flying fingers was that of a bull. There was a young girl riding it. Another panel showed the bull rising in the air and crossing the sea. The girl looked back over the waves towards young men running in panic to the cliffside. Could it be? Was this scene the ravishing of Europa, and were those boys Cadmus and his brothers? A murmur rose from the onlookers, who pressed round on all sides to get a closer look. The following series of images made it all too clear what Arachne was up to. Here was Asteria, daughter of the Titans Phoebe and Cius, despairingly turning herself into a quail to try and escape the rapacious attentions of Zeus in the shape of an eagle. Next to this, Arachne wove a picture of Zeus as a swan, insinuating himself around the body of Tyndareus's wife, Leda. Now he was a dancing satyr, chasing the beautiful Antiope. Next, the lustful god appeared in one of his strangest metamorphoses, a shower of golden rain, in which unlikely manifestation he could be clearly seen impregnating the imprisoned Danae, daughter of King Acrisius of Argos. Many of these ravishings and seductions were the subjects of mortal gossip. For Arachne to be bringing them to life in coloured silk was unpardonable. Further scenes of Zeus's depraved career followed. The hapless nymph Aegina hidden in his flame, and the lovely Persephone molested by him in the form of a speckled snake. The rumour that in this manner Zeus had once taken Persephone, his own daughter by Demeter, had been whispered, but for Arachne to show it now was sacrilege. Yet Zeus was not the only god whose tales of degeneracy she wrote in thread. Scenes of Poseidon now appeared, the sea god shown first as a bull, galloping after the frightened Arne of Thessaly, then disguised as the mortal Enipeus, so as to win the lovely Tyro. Finally, as a dolphin in his pursuit of the lovely Melantho, daughter of Deucalion. Apollo's depredations were the next to appear, Apollo the hawk, Apollo the lion, Apollo the shepherd, despoiling maidens without pity or shame. And Dionysus, too, was portrayed,
disguising himself as a large cluster of grapes to deceive the beautiful Erigone, and, in a fit of temper, transforming Alcathoe and the Miniades into bats for daring to prefer a contemplative life to one of frenzied revelry. The Miniades were daughters of Minyas, a king of Boeotia. They were Lucipe, Asipe, and Alcathoe. A recently discovered species of European bat is named the Alcathoe in her honour. Their fate was often used as a warning to those who were tempted away from a life of Dionysian revelry. We are more likely to expect warnings in the other direction these days. All these episodes and more were summoned by Arachne's art. They shared the common theme of the gods taking deceitful and often savage advantage of mortal females. Arachne completed her work by weaving around it a patterned edge of interlacing flowers and ivy leaves. When she was done, she calmly pushed the shuttle to one side and stood up to stretch.